Welcome to the Eco News Report. I'm your host this week, Tom Wheeler, Executive Director of EPIC, the Environmental Protection Information Center. And joining me, as always, are Scott Greeson, Friends of the Yale River. Hey, Scott.
Hey, Tom.
And Jen Kalt of Humble Baykeeper. Hey, Jen.
Hello.
All right. So we're going to talk about how to deal with climate change. And so we've talked a little bit about this before. And
it's pretty straightforward, really.
Yeah. When I talk about when dealing with climate change, this is not necessarily like the prescription that the planet needs to take to eliminate or, you know, reduce the threat of global climate change. This is how we can take individual steps in our own lives to emotionally deal with climate change. So this is a companion piece to one perhaps earlier in the show's history where we talked about climate grief and this notion of pre-traumatic stress syndrome, where we see something coming and we see that it's just going to screw us royally and having to live with that knowledge. All right. So our discussion today is kind of focused around this opinion piece that was put out into the New York Times by Emma Maris. I hope I'm pronouncing her last name correctly because I'm crap at that. Entitled How to Stop Freaking Out and Tackle Climate Change. So this gives a multi-point piece, January 10th, 2020. And Emma's work is largely focused on this Jordan Cove LNG liquid natural gas pipeline. So let's just kind of ground the conversation by thinking about an individual project, because that's what Emma, I think, was probably doing when she was thinking about writing this op-ed. So, Scott, what the heck is this Jordan Cove pipeline?
As I understand it, it's a combination of the actual docking and storage facilities that would be in Coos Bay, Oregon, and a pipeline that would stretch from Coos Bay over to an existing pipeline south of Klamath Falls. So it's, I think, about 230 miles of proposed pipeline that would cross both the Rogue River and the Klamath River, and, you know, has been the focus of considerable organizing effort on the part of folks in Oregon, especially Southwest Oregon, and also folks on the Klamath who are worried about its impacts on the Klamath. And, you know, the concerns are a combination of the broader climate effects of continuing to, you know, focus our energy system on fossil fuel use, whether it's quote unquote natural unquote gas or, you know, other fossil fuels, and, you know, the immediate effects on private lands, on the rivers, on the forests of Oregon's Coast Range, and of course on the species that depend on those places. So it's both the familiar and sort of more contemporary aspects of this fight. I think one of the things that's really interesting to me as a lawyer advocate and somebody who deals with a lot of federal state issues is the way that the project proponent has now withdrawn its application after the state of Oregon told them basically, no, you can't do this. But that looks like a gambit basically to just ignore the state of Oregon and go ahead and do this with just federal permission, which is a little too familiar at this point.
Well, and it's reminiscent of the liquefied natural gas export facility that was proposed for Samoa in 2003, because there was a lot of consternation over there potentially being federal preemption that would basically make state and local rules moot. And although this is an export facility, so the idea here is to export liquid natural gas from Coos Bay, getting it there through a pipeline that goes across the Klamath, Rogue, Umpqua rivers.
Yeah.
And through lots of national forest.
And it's worth noting that, you know, we faced and ultimately prevailed over a really similar federal preemption argument when Friends of the Yale and Katz won our case challenging the North Coast Railroad Authority. And, you know, ultimately, you know, with a unanimous California Supreme Court decision, we wound up in a place where the state has asserted, and I think this is going to stand, that with state property, at least, the state can continue to use CEQA and insist on environmental regulations. The idea that the federal government could kind of override state environmental protections is a real reversal of the way that federal environmental law has been working for the last couple, 3 decades. And it's a, you know, sort of token of the way the Trump administration is rolling. It's states' rights, except where, you know, corporations want otherwise.
It's funny that states' rights just seems to be a shallow shell that just covers, you know,
racial discrimination.
Yeah. And yeah.
Election
Jim
suppression.
Crow laws. And yeah. Who'd have thunk it?
Kind of striking. So I think that's a, you know, that's the basic background on that project. You know, it's pretty obvious why people are fighting it. Having said that, she, Emma Maris, the author of this piece you're talking about, How to Stop Freaking Out and Tackle Climate Change, draws some much larger conclusions from her work. And, you know, this is stuff that I think is really valuable for us as activists, you know, for folks who are paying attention to these issues at all. And, you know, frankly, for our whole culture, because it's really difficult to think about this stuff. Jen, you were just talking about this before the show.
Yeah, I mean, in the media environment that we're living in now, it's hard to really lift yourself up after being barraged by this constant deluge of articles about the climate impacts are all around the world, the animals that are being killed in massive fires, the sea level rise. Just, it's just constant, and it's really depressing, frankly. And, you know, it's one thing to keep up on the latest science, but, you know, to be constantly reading about a world on fire or underwater is, it's really overwhelming. And, you know, whether you're an activist on a day-to-day basis like we are, or someone who's, you know, living their life and thinking about their children and what are we going to do here. So that's the How to Stop Freaking Out and Tackle Climate Change idea here is she has basically a 5-step program. And the first one I think is really important, which is called Ditch the Shame. And it's basically, you know, we're not going to stop climate change based on a bunch of individual actions. You know, like me washing and reusing plastic bags is probably not going to stop climate change. You know, we all do what we can, but to a certain extent, all these individual actions are nearly impossible to make huge change because we live in a world that was created for automobiles. And most of us, you know, have jobs that we have to get to, and we can't afford to live in walkable communities and so on and so forth. You know, it's more expensive to choose the more sustainable, eco-groovy products, all that kind of stuff. And so just not feeling bad about yourself for doing what you can and not kicking yourself for the things you can't really change at this point in your life is, it's...
Well, and, you know, there's a level where it's important to sort of make choices that do matter. But fundamentally, you know, the essay quotes one of my favorite writers, Marianne E. Sagler, saying the belief that this enormous existential problem could have been fixed if all of us had just tweaked our consumptive habits is not only preposterous, it's dangerous. We can't fix this with consumer changes. That's it just doesn't work that way. And so we got to let go of that, you know, the guilt.
Well, so it reminds me of, as everything does now, having lived through the trauma that was Terrigen, it reminds me of some of the project opponents after that project was denied. They said, well, it doesn't really matter. Let's just encourage people to do better in their own lives and that'll be good. And it's like, no, we need a ton of renewable energy. We're going to need to overproduce what we're currently producing to have a combustion-free future. And, you know, getting people to drive 55, while fantastic, I'm glad whenever somebody is driving a little bit slower to improve their overall fuel efficiency. Scott disagrees as a lead-footed individual, but but it's not going to...
At least stay in the right lane.
It's not going to add up. Yeah.
Well, and, you know, conservation is important, but it's not the be-all, end-all. You know, right. All it takes is one trip to Sacramento and, or, you know, any other big city. And the you know, small population like ours, having solar panel to recharge our laptops isn't going to make a dent.
So let's
jump to 2, because I think that this first one is...
Yeah, and again, first one is ditch the shame. And as Emma Maris says, it's the key to everything. everything else. But let's just run through the whole five steps. Step two is focus on systems, not yourself. I think we're already thinking about that. Step three, join an effective group. Step four, define your role. And step five, know what you are fighting for, not just what you're fighting against. So we talked a little bit already about focusing on systems, that, you know, ditch the shame idea really leads into this, that to the extent we're focusing on whether our consumption is greener than thou, we're not focusing on the political systems and on the economic systems that we have to change. You know, and I think it's really helpful these days that we are thinking more about systems. I think some of the presidential candidates on the Democratic side have been raising important issues about big systems and the need to change them. But it's hard to think about this stuff from the perspective of, you know, a daily life as a consumer. And we got to really rethink ourselves as citizens.
And I want to just put a plug in that the power of democracy is best felt at the local level, right? Like, as you go up a layer of the onion, you lose a little bit of power. But at right. the local level, this is where we have our best chance of being effective. And one of the things that I would like to see more of is that for people to start thinking about the Green New Deal as something outside of Congress and start to incorporate the principles of something like that at the local level. Because that's really the promise of the Green New Deal, is to add climate into the political discourse. And it will be most effective at the local level.
Yeah. Step three, join an effective group. And again, let's do the five again. Ditch the shame, step one. Step two is focus on systems, not yourself. Step three, join an effective group. Step four, define your role. Step five, know what you're fighting for. So joining an effective group.
So there are three effective groups in the room right now. The Environmental Protection Information Center, or EPIC, yeah, yeah. Humble Baykeeper, and Friends of the Eel River, all of which you should support.
I think for Emma Maris, the author of this piece, again, January 10th, 2020 piece in the New York Times, what she's talking about is the campaign she's part of to fight this Jordan Cove liquid natural gas pipeline. And the idea is work with a larger group that is effective to make real change. Nobody can do this by themselves. I think that's one of the most important lessons I've learned, is you cannot do this work on your own. You got to be part of an organization that carries our arguments first.
And we have a ton of those groups locally. And as the executive director of a nonprofit, we can only do so much with our existing staff. And if there's a person out there who has a good idea of something else that should be done and is willing to put in the work, you know, EPIC has a mailing list of 15,000 people, and we have all of these sort of institutional resources that could help amplify your voice. But we need people to step up and to donate some of their time towards a cause that they care about. And there are other local groups out there as well who are entirely reliant upon volunteers for all of their advocacy. 350 Humboldt, which is just about the only voice out there constantly talking about climate change at a local level, is all volunteer based. And so get your butt up off the couch and go to 350 Humboldt meeting. They meet at a Mexican restaurant. So like it's not even that onerous. You know, you get to have some flautas with your discussion of sea level rise.
And the Coalition for Responsible Transportation Priorities is an important group working on transportation issues locally. And, you know, they're also primarily volunteer-based. They just started asking people to join and become a member of their organization. And, you know, they're making it easier for people to bike and walk everywhere, which is something we really need in this community.
Check out an earlier issue of the Eco News Report on urbanism featuring the executive director of CRTP, Colin Fisk. Welcome to the Eco News Report. I'm your host this week, Tom Wheeler. We're talking about how to make a difference in this world on climate change and actually probably on broader issues as well.
So I want to withdraw and amend one of my previous comments, which was that you can't get anything done as a single person, as a single individual. And I think the caveat there is that all of these projects start with somebody having an idea, having an insight, having a sense about how this could change and get better if we do this differently. And, you know, if you have that kind of idea, it's really important to give that to the community and, you know, help other people share it so that they can help make that thing happen. And, you know, all of these ideas start with an insight. They start with somebody saying, hey, let's do this. So just because a group doesn't yet exist doesn't mean it can't be created. And just because a group exists doesn't mean it's effective. So there's a whole lot more to talk about there in terms of how to make your group effective. We should probably, you know, be spending some time on this show thinking about that part of it. But, you know, one of the things you want to do is work with a group that knows what it's doing and why. Not just a group that has been around for a long time and wants to keep its proud legacy alive.
Yeah, and I think it's important to also say that people should follow their passion. You know, just because we're environmental activists doesn't mean that we're calling for everyone to join environmental movements. You know, addressing climate change also includes social justice of, you know, a whole bunch of different types. It includes addressing homelessness. It includes...
Yeah, there's a whole wide world out there of social causes to... that you could get involved in, and all of them to feel to some degree like climate change, that, you know, how are we ever going to solve homelessness? Well, AHA is doing cool stuff. You know, they have their shower trailer that they purchased, and that is just individuals who are passionate about the issue doing something. So go do something.
Yeah.
And I think that's really the bottom line is doing something is part of addressing your freaking out or your climate grief or your, you know, feeling overwhelmed. It's figuring out how to do something that makes a difference that is really key.
Right. But it's almost anything. I mean, say your passion is for wildlife. You can go to Bird Ally X and help them do wildlife rehab. You can join the coast survey teams and help develop really crucial information about what's happening in ocean wildlife by taking notes on your beach walks. You know, there's all kinds of things people can do from every kind of personality, you know, any kind of passion you've got. There's a way to engage.
Oh, so this is, let me just have one little sec to try to find this quote. So it's a weird one. So there is a New Yorker article from now 2 years ago, and it had to do with one of the Bush kids or some Bush, Jonathan Bush. And one of the best life pieces of advice is contained in this letter that Jonathan Bush wrote to employees of his company as he was leaving the company. And I can't believe that I'm citing a Bush, but I feel like this quote really gets at a lot of what we're talking about. And it's this: I believe that working for something larger than yourself is the greatest thing a human can do. A family, a cause, a company, a country. These things give shape and purpose to an otherwise mechanical and brief human existence. The downside about things that are larger than ourselves, of course, is that we who have the privilege of serving them ourselves are fungible. It is a fundamental definition. You can't have the grace of the one without the other. I can't believe that I think about this quote at least once a month, and I always have to Google the same thing to find it. So if you want to read the article, I don't know if it will have other gems like it, but that is Paul Singer, Doomsday Investor, from the August 20th, 2018 issue of The New Yorker.
And I think that tells us that these are, you know, principles broadly applicable to human life. They're not about, you know, a particular partisan perspective. But, you know, back to Emma Maris's piece, you know, how to stop freaking out and tackle climate change. You know, what she's offering here with this 5-step plan: ditch the shame, focus on systems, not yourself, join an effective group, define your role, and know what you're fighting for, is, you know, a way to not just deal with the overwhelming grief and terror that the news brings us, but also to remain psychologically healthy, you know, in the face of this, and to become, as you're saying, Tom, part of something bigger than ourselves, which is what we've always had.
All right. So let's move on to 4. Define our role. Define your role. So all of us are good at something. Sometimes it feels
Speak for yourself.
Yeah. Sometimes it doesn't really feel like that's true, but, but Scott has a lovely radio voice. So there's at least something there.
Found it.
I sound like a dying Muppet. So I don't know. But we each have something that we're good at. You know, I can contribute something. And so figure out what that thing is that you're good at. Even if it's just writing letters to the editor, we can all contribute something to this larger cause. And it doesn't mean that you need to be rich. It doesn't mean that you need to be smart or attractive or anything else. There's a role for all of us, and you just need to do what you're good at.
One caveat, and I think this is well taken from Emma Maris's piece, is take care not to overdo it at first and risk burning out. Set a sustainable level of involvement for yourself and keep it up. And this is one of the harder things to do, I think, especially when you're caught up in the intensity of a campaign, especially a volunteer-led campaign. It always feels like there's, you know, more work than you can do in 24 hours, and there's a sort of competitive intensity that people develop, and it's hard, but it's essential to pace yourself. Be realistic. Work on a schedule.
Walk your dog.
There you go. Yeah.
What's that quote from Ed Abbey? Here it is. This is the quotes.
This isn't the one about closing the border and we'll all be fine. Yeah.
No. This is one final paragraph of advice. Do not burn yourselves out. Be, as I am, a reluctant enthusiast, a part-time crusader, a half-hearted fanatic. Save the other half of yourself and your lives for pleasure and adventure. It is not enough to fight for the land. It is even more important to enjoy it while you can, while it's still here. So get out and hunt and fish and mess around with your friends, ramble out yonder and explore the forest, climb the mountains, bag the big peaks, run the rivers, breathe deep of that sweet yet lucid air. Sit quietly for a while, contemplate the precious stillness, the lovely, mysterious, and awesome space. Enjoy yourselves, keep your brain in your head, and your head firmly attached to your body, the body active and alive. And I promise you this much. I promise you this one sweet victory over our enemies, over those desk-bound men and women with their hearts in a safe deposit box and their eyes hypnotized by desk calculators. Desk calculators, how cute and dated. I promise you this, you will outlive the bastards. I hope I can say bastards on the radio.
Unfortunately, demographics don't support that idea.
I mean,
the richer you are, the longer you live.
Yeah.
It's good advice for people who are prone to work too much and burn out, though.
Totally.
I mean, you know, if you burn out, you're not helping anybody.
Right.
Or the planet.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, that goes back to one of the fundamental principles of first aid. If you're in a situation where somebody's injured, the first thing you do isn't, go figure out how to help them. It's figure out how to make sure you don't get hurt and become another injury, you know? So you got to take care of yourself if you're going to, you know, take care of the planet.
All right. And let's move on to the last step. Know what you're fighting for, not just what you're fighting against. And I think that this is one that took me a while to figure out because, you know, I always conceive of fights as against something and to remind myself to bag the lovely peaks and to get out there while I can and whatever else. Yeah. So fight for something, not just against something. So Scott, for Friends of the Eel River, what are you fighting for in the Eel River? What animates your work?
Oh, we're fighting to basically free the eel from the two dams, Scott Dam and Cape Horn Dam, that have kind of messed it up pretty severely, and especially its fisheries, for about a century now. And really what's at the core of that is we're working to try to bring back a kind of natural abundance. We want to see wild fish, not just hatchery fish, you know, at sustainable, self-supporting levels across the Eel River watershed and really across Northern California. We want to see them supporting not just the ecosystems, but people and the tribal nations, you know.
I think that you probably want to support that feeling when you go out and you look at a river and you see a little flicker of silver and some splashing of water and the excitement that you get in your heart and this perspective that there is something larger than yourself at play.
Yeah. And ultimately what we're trying to do is put things back. You know, put connections back, let not things, but that the fish find their way home. And, you know, it's really exciting. It's also boring and difficult, but that the ultimate goal for us is really exciting now that we've begun to understand that the fish we're trying to recover are in fact still there behind the dams. And all we've got to do is get the dams out and let the fish come back. They're there. We've just got to let them have the space again. So, you know, that's a core idea for us is recovery.
Jen, do you want to talk about what Baykeeper is fighting for, or what animates your work for Baykeeper?
Sure. I mean, it's very similar. Restoring clean water for everyone, habitat for fish, but it's also for Baykeeper so people can eat from Humboldt Bay, so people yeah. can continue to teach their children that you can go down to Humboldt Bay and catch a fish or dig up some clams, and that they're healthy to eat, and you know that you can go down to the bay and kayak anytime you want to, and you know, just trying to get people more connected to their waterways. And so it's not just the bay, but it's, you know, the Eel River, the Mad River, which we rely on for drinking water, and just, you know, seeing humans as part of the natural world working together for a healthier planet and humanity too.
So is there anything missing from this list? So once again, to end, we have ditch the shame, focus on systems and not yourself, join an effective group, define your role within that effective group, and know what you're fighting for and not just what you're fighting against. Does anyone have a sixth rule here? Well, I think that our bit about save a piece for yourself, don't burn yourself out. And that's, and maybe it's something that when you just get too deep into it, that's when it becomes a problem. And for most people, you may not experience this, but at least as someone who spends 50 hours a week thinking about these things, it is my largest struggle is how am I going to be able to maintain this over the course of a career? It's easy to do for 5 years, but thinking about doing this for, you know, I'm 32 years old. Let's assume that Social Security still exists when I'm 65. I have to do this for double my life. That sounds horrible. I don't know if I can.
It goes a lot faster than you think.
Okay.
I think
for your sage advice.
I think I would say what's missing from this list, not really missing, but it maybe should be more explicit, is nurturing your connections with other people. And we've talked about this on the show before, how important it is to recognize the people that you're in this with together, because especially in this day and age, we live in a culture where everyone's sitting behind their computers. They don't pick up the phone. They don't run into each other and chat as often as we should. And so having more intentional social interaction with people that you know, that are important to you and that help you get by and help you celebrate the good things in life.
Yeah. And that really, that goes to the place I was reaching for, Jen, in terms of what's missing from this list. It's not just joining an effective group. It's also being part of a community that supports you and that where you support other people. I think that there is a lot to say and very important work to be done in terms of recognizing and adapting to the different kinds of people that are in the world. And one particular thread that I think is always very challenging in social change movements and in my experience in the environmental movement is, how do you deal with dysfunctional people? How do you deal with people who sort of center their own challenges and trauma, you know, when they're coming to an organization or a campaign? Those are really difficult things to address, and often I think wind up derailing a lot of people's engagement. And, you know, I think it'd be very useful for us to spend some more time talking about cultures of effective resistance and how we develop those, and how in a lot of ways the culture that we've grown up in, mainstream American culture, is not that, you know, and makes it harder to do good work that's really supportive and you know, doesn't contain within it another element of oppression, I guess is a way to put it.
All right.
Is that too overwhelming?
No.
It's kind of sad.
Yeah. No. This whole thing is just...
Yeah.
This has been another issue of the Eco News Report. Thank you for joining us. And join us again next week on this time and channel for more environmental news from the North Coast of California.